The creature swooped up through the branches and landed in a bundle of twigs Gordon guessed to be its nest. It stood there, like a small lordling, haughty and proud. Then it squawked and dove toward the thicket again. As it passed out of sight, there was another tiny rustle. Then the mockingbird swooped into view again. Gordon idly picked at the loam with his bow while loosening the loop on his revolver, trying hard to maintain a frozen expression of nonchalance. He whistled through fear-dry lips as he walked slowly, moving neither toward the thicket nor away from it, but in the direction of a large, grand fir. Something behind that thicket had set off the mockingbird's nest defense response, and that something was trying hard to ignore the nuisance attacks, to stay silently hidden. Alerted, Gordon recognized a hunting blind. He sauntered with exaggerated carelessness, but as soon as he passed behind the fir, he drew his revolver and ran into the forest at a sharp angle, crouching, trying to keep the bulk of the tree between himself and the blackberry bramble. He remained in the tree's umbra only a moment. Surprise protected him a moment longer. Then the cracking of three loud shots, all of different caliber, diffracted down the lattice of trees. Gordon sprinted to a fallen log at the top of a small rise. Three more bangs pealed out as he dove over the decaying trunk and hit the ground on the other side to a sharp snapping sound and stabbing pain in his right arm. He felt a moment's blind panic as the hand holding his revolver cramped. If he had broken his arm! Blood soaked the cuff of his U.S. government-issue tunic. Dread exaggerated the pain until he pulled back his sleeve and saw a long, shallow gash with slivers of wood hanging from the laceration. It was the bow that had broken, stabbing him as he fell on it. Gordon threw the fragments aside and scrambled on hands and knees up a narrow gully to the right, keeping low to take advantage of the creek bed and underbrush. Behind him, whoops of gleeful chase carried over the tiny hillock. The following minutes were a blur of whipping branches and sudden zigzags. When he splashed into a narrow rivulet, Gordon whirled, then hurried against the flow. Hunted men often will run downstream, he remembered, racing upslope, hoping his enemies knew that bit of trivia. He hopped from stone to stone, trying not to dislodge mud into the water. Then he jumped off into the forest again. There were shouts behind him. Gordon's own footfall seemed loud enough to wake sleeping bears. Twice he caught his breath behind boulders or clumps of foliage, thinking as well as practicing silence. Finally, the shouts diminished with distance. Gordon sighed as he settled back against the large oak and pulled out his belt pouch aid kit. The wound would be all right. There was no reason to expect infection from the polished wood of the bow. It hurt like hell, but the tear was far from vessels or tendons. He bound it in boiled cloth and simply ignored the pain as he got up and looked around. To his surprise, he recognized two landmarks at once: the towering, shattered sign of the Oak Ridge Motel, seen over the treetops, and a cattle grate across a worn asphalt path just to the east. Gordon moved quickly to the place where he had cached his goods. They were exactly as he had left them. Apparently, the fates were not so unsubtle as to deal him another blow just yet. He knew they didn't operate that way. They always let you hope for a while longer, then strung it out before they really let you have it. Now, the stalked turned stalker. Cautiously, Gordon sought out the blackberry blind with its irate resident mockingbird. As expected, it was empty now. He crept around behind to get the ambusher's point of view and sat there for a few minutes as the afternoon waned, looking and thinking. They had had the drop on him, that was for certain. From this point of view, it was hard to see how they had missed when the three men fired on him. Were they so surprised by his sudden break for it? They must have had semi-automatic weapons, yet he only remembered six shots. Either they were being very stingy with ammo, or... He approached the grand fir across the clearing. Two fresh scars blemished the bark 10 feet up. 10 feet? They couldn't be such bad marksmen. So... It all fit. They had never meant to kill him at all. They had aimed high on purpose to give him a scare and drive him off. No wonder his pursuers never really came close to catching him during his escape into the forest. Gordon's lip curled. Ironically, this made his assailants easier to hate. Unthinking malice he had come to accept, as one must accept foul weather and savage beasts. So many former Americans have become little better than barbarians. But calculated contempt like this was something he had to take personally. These men had the concept of mercy. Still, they had robbed, injured, and terrorized him. He remembered Roger Septien taunting him from that bone-dry hillside. These bastards were no better at all. Gordon picked up their trail 100 yards to the west of the blind. The boot prints were clear and uncovered, almost arrogant in their openness. He took his time, but he never even considered turning back. It was approaching dusk before the palisade that surrounded New Oak Ridge was in sight. An open area that had once been a city park was enclosed by a high wooden fence. From within could be heard the lowing of cattle. A horse whinnied. Gordon smelled hay and the rich odors of livestock. Nearby, a still higher palisade surrounded 3 blocks of what had once been the southwest corner of Oak Ridge Town. A row of 2-story buildings, half a block long, took up the center of the village. Gordon could see the tops of these over the wall, and a water tower with a crow's nest atop it. A silhouetted figure stood watch, looking out over the dimming forest. It looked like a prosperous community, perhaps the best off he had encountered since leaving Idaho. Trees had been cut to make a free fire zone around the village wall, but that was some time ago. Undergrowth half as high as a man had encroached on the cleared field.
"Well, there can't be many survivalists in the area anymore, or they'd be a whole lot less careless. Let's see what the main entrance is like."
He skirted around the open area toward the south side of the village. On hearing voices, he drew up cautiously behind the curtain of undergrowth. A large wooden gate swung open. 2 armed men sauntered out, looked around, then waved to someone within. With a shout and a snap of reins, a wagon pulled by 2 draft horses sallied through, then stopped. The driver turned to speak to the 2 guards.
"Tell the mayor I appreciate the loan, Jeff. I know my stead is in the hole pretty deep, but we'll pay him back out of next year's harvest for sure. He already owns a piece of the farm, so it ought to be a good investment for him."
One of the guards nodded.
"Sure thing, sonny. Now you be careful on your way out, okay? Some of the boys spotted a loner down at the east end of Old Town today. There was some shooting."
The farmer's breath caught audibly.
Was anyone hurt? Are you sure it was just a loner?"
"Yeah, pretty sure. He ran like a rabbit, according to Bob."
Gordon's pulse pounded faster. The insults had reached a point almost beyond bearing. He put his left hand inside his shirt and felt the whistle Abby had given him, hanging from its chain around his neck. He took some comfort from it, remembering decency.
"The feller did the mayor a real favor, though," the first guard went on. "Found a hidey hole full of drugs before Bob's guys drove him off. Mayor's going to pass some of them around to some of the owners at a party tonight to find out what they'll do. I sure wish I moved in those circles."
"Me too,"
the younger watchman agreed.
"Hey, Sonny, you think the mayor might pay you some of your bonus in drugs if you make quota this year? You could have a real party."
Sonny smiled sheepishly and shrugged. Then for some reason his head drooped. The older guard looked at him quizzically.
"What's the matter?"
he asked. Sonny shook his head. Gordon could barely hear him when he spoke.
"We don't wish for very much anymore, do we, Gary?"
Gary frowned.
"What do you mean?"
"I mean, as long as we're wishing to be like the mayor's cronies, why don't we wish we had a mayor without cronies at all?"
"Why?"
"Sally and I had 3 girls and 2 boys before the doom, Gary."
"I remember, Sonny, but..."
"Hal and Peter died in the war, but I counted me and Sally blessed that all 3 girls grew up."
"Blessed?" "Sonny, it's not your fault. It's just bad luck."
"Bad luck?"
The farmer snorted.
"One raped to death when those reavers came through. Peggy dead in childbirth, and my little Susan... She's got gray hair, Gary. She looks like Sally's sister."
There was a long stretch of silence. The older guard put his hand on the farmer's arm.
"I'll bring a jug around tomorrow, Sonny. I promise. We'll talk about the old days, you know, like we used to." The farmer nodded without looking up. He shouted,
"Yeah!"
and snapped the reins. For a long moment, the guard looked after the creaking wagon, chewing on a grass stem. Finally, he turned to his younger companion.
"Jimmy, did I ever tell you about Portland? Sonny and I used to go there before the war. They had this mayor, back when I was a kid, who used to pose for..."
They passed through the gate, out of Gordon's hearing. Under other circumstances, Gordon might have pondered hours over what that one small conversation had revealed about the social structure of Oak Ridge and its environs. The farmer's crop indebtedness, for instance. It was a classic early stage of share-kind serfdom. He had read about things like this in sophomore history tutorial, long ago, and in another world. They were features of feudalism. But right now, Gordon had no time for philosophy or sociology. His emotions churned. Outrage over what had happened today was nothing next to his anger over the proposed use of the drugs he had found. When he thought of what that doctor in Wyoming could do with such medicines, why, most of the substances wouldn't even make these ignorant savages high. Gordon was fed up. His bandaged right arm throbbed. "I'll bet I could scale those walls without much trouble, find the storage hut and reclaim what I found, along with some extra to make up for the insults, the pain, my broken bowl." The image wasn't satisfying enough. Gordon embellished. He envisioned dropping in on the mayor's party and wasting all the power-hungry bastards who were making a midget empire out of this corner of the Dark Age. He imagined acquiring power. Power to do good. Power to force these yokels to use the education of their younger days before the learned generation disappeared forever from the world. Why? Why is nobody anywhere taking responsibility for putting things right again? I'd help. I'd dedicate my life to such a leader. But the big dreams all seem to be gone. All the good men, like Lieutenant Van and Drew Sims, died defending them. I must be the only one left who still believes in them. Leaving was out of the question, of course. A combination of pride, obstinacy, and simple gonadal fury rooted him in his tracks. Here he would do battle, and that was that. Maybe there's an idealist's militia in heaven or in hell. I guess I'll find out soon. Fortunately, the war hormones left a little space for his forebrain to choose tactics. As the afternoon faded, he thought about what he was going to do. Gordon stepped back into the shadows, and a branch brushed by, dislodging his cap. He caught it before it fell to the ground, was about to put it back on, but then stopped abruptly and looked at it. The burnished image of a horseman glinted back at him, a brass figure backed by a ribbon motto in Latin. Gordon watched shifting highlights in the shiny emblem, and slowly he smiled. It would be audacious, perhaps much more so than attempting the fence in the darkness, but the idea had a pleasing symmetry that appealed to Gordon. He was probably the last man alive who would choose a path of greater danger purely for aesthetic reasons, and he was glad. If the scheme failed, it would still be spectacular. It required a brief foray into the ruins of old Oak Ridge, beyond the post-war village, to a structure certain to be among the least looted in town. He set the cap back on his head as he moved to take advantage of the remaining light. An hour later, Gordon left the gutted buildings of the old town and stepped briskly along the pitted asphalt road, retracing his steps in the gathering dusk. Taking a long detour through the forest, he came at last to the road Sonny had used, south of the village wall. Now he approached boldly, guided by a solitary lantern hanging over the broad gate. The guard was criminally lax. Gordon came within 30 feet, unchallenged. He saw a shadowy sentry standing on a parapet over near the far end of the palisade, but the idiot was looking the other way.
Gordon took a deep breath, put Abby's whistle to his lips, and blew three hard blasts. The shrill screams pealed through the buildings and forest like the shriek of a stooping raptor. Hurried footsteps pounded along the parapet. Three men carrying shotguns and oil lanterns appeared above the gate and stared down at him in the gathering twilight.
Well, who are you? What do you want?
I must speak with someone in authority,
Gordon hailed.
This is official business, and I demand entry to the town of Oak Ridge.
That certainly put them off their routine. There was a long, stunned silence as the guards blinked, first at him and then at each other. Finally, one man hurried off, while the first speaker cleared his throat.
Come again? Are you feverish? Have you got the sickness?
Gordon shook his head.
I am not ill. I am tired and hungry and angry over being shot at. But settling all that can wait until I have discharged my duty here.
This time the chief guard's voice cracked in blank perplexity.
Discharged? What the hell are you talking about, man?
Hurried footsteps echoed on the parapet. Several more men arrived, followed by a number of children and women who began to string out to the left and right. Discipline, apparently, wasn't well practiced in Oak Ridge. The local tyrant and his cronies had had things their way for a long time. Gordon repeated himself, slowly and firmly, giving it his best Polonius voice.
I demand to speak with your superiors. You are trying my patience keeping me out here, and it will definitely go into my report. Now get somebody here with authority to open this gate.
The crowd thickened until an unbroken forest of silhouettes topped the palisade. They stared down at Gordon as a group of figures appeared on the parapet to the right, carrying lanterns. The onlookers on that side made way for the newcomers.
Look, loner, the chief guard said, you're just asking for a bullet. We got no official business with anyone outside this valley. Haven't since we broke relations with that commie place down at Blakeville years ago. You can bet your ass I'm not bothering the mayor for some crazy...
The man turned in surprise as the party of dignitaries reached the gate.
Well, Mr. Mayor, I'm sorry about the ruckus, but...
I was nearby anyway. Heard the commotion. What's going on here?
The guard gestured.
We got a fella out there babbling like nothing I've heard since the crazy times. He must be sick, or one of those loonies that always used to come through.
I'll take care of this.
In the growing darkness, the new figure leaned over the parapet.
I'm the mayor of Oak Ridge, he announced. We don't believe in charity here, but if you're that fellow who found the goodies this afternoon and graciously donated them to my boys, I'll admit we owe you. I'll have a nice hot meal lowered over the gate and a blanket. You can sleep there by the road. Tomorrow, though, you gotta be gone. We don't want no diseases here, and from what my guards tell me, you must be delirious.
Gordon smiled.
Your generosity impresses me, Mr. Mayor, but I have come too far on official business to turn away now. First off, can you tell me if Oak Ridge has a working wireless or fiber optic facility?
The silence brought on by his non sequitur was long and heavy. Gordon could imagine the mayor's puzzlement. At last, the boss man answered.
We haven't had a radio in 10 years. Nothing's worked since then.
Why, what has that got to do with any...
That's a shame. The airwaves have been a shambles since the war, of course,
he improvised.
All the radioactivity, you know, but I'd hoped I could try to use your transmitter to report back to my superiors.
He delivered the lines with aplomb. This time, they brought not silence, but a surge of amazed whispers up and down the parapet. Gordon guessed that most of the population of Oak Ridge must be up there by now. He hoped the wall was well built. It was not in his plan to enter the town like Joshua. He had quite another legend in mind.
Get a lantern over here,
the mayor commanded.
Not that one, you idiot, the one with a reflector.
Yes, now shine it on that man, I want to look at him.
A bulky lamp was brought forth, and there was a rattle as light speared out at Gordon. He was expecting it, though, and neither covered his eyes nor squinted. He shifted the leather bag and turned to bring his costume to the best angle. The letter carrier's cap, with its polished crest, sat at a rakish angle on his head. The muttering of the crowd grew louder.
"Mr. Mayor," he called, "my patience is limited. I already will have to have words with you about the behavior of your boys this afternoon. Don't force me to exercise my authority in ways both of us would find unpleasant. You're on the verge of losing your privilege of communication with the rest of the nation."
The mayor shifted his weight back and forth rapidly.
"Communication? Nation? What is this blither? It's just the Blakeville commune, those self-righteous twits down at Culp Creek, and Satan knows what savages beyond them. Who the hell are you, anyway?"
Gordon touched his cap.
"Gordon Krantz of the United States Postal Service. I'm the courier assigned to reestablish a mail route in Idaho and Lower Oregon, and general federal inspector for the region."
And to imagine, he had been embarrassed playing Santa Claus back in Pineview. Gordon hadn't thought of the last part about being a federal inspector until it was out of his mouth. Was it inspiration or a dare? "Well, might as well be hanged for a sheep as a goat," he thought. The crowd was in tumult. Several times Gordon heard the words "outside" and "inspector," and especially "mailman." When the mayor shouted for silence, it came slowly, trailing off into a rapt hush.
"So you're a mailman."
The sneer was sarcastic.
"What kind of idiots do you take us for, Krantz? A shiny suit makes you a government official? What government? What proof can you give us? Show us you're not a wild lunatic raving with radiation fever."
Gordon pulled out the papers he had prepared only an hour before, using the seal stamp he had found in the ruins of the Oak Ridge post office.
"I have credentials here."
But he was interrupted at once.
"Keep your papers to yourself, loony. We're not letting you come close enough to infect us with your fever."
The mayor straightened and waved an arm in the air, addressing his subjects.
"You all remember how crazies and imposters used to come around during the chaos years, claiming to be everything from the Antichrist to Porky Pig? Well, there's one fact we can all depend on. Crazies come and crazies go, but there's only one government. That's what we got right here."
He turned back to Gordon.
"You're lucky this isn't like the plague years, loony. Back then a case like yours would have called for immediate cure, by cremation."
Gordon cursed silently. The local tyrant was slick and certainly no easy bluff. If they wouldn't even look at the credentials he had forged, the trip into Old Town this afternoon had been wasted. Gordon was down to his last ace. He smiled for the crowd, but he really wanted to cross his fingers. From a side pocket of the leather bag, he pulled out a small bundle. Gordon made a pretense of shuffling through the packet, squinting at labels he knew by heart.
"Is there a Donald Smith here?"
he called up at the townspeople. Heads turned left and right in sudden, hushed conversation. Their confusion was obvious even in the gathering darkness. Finally, someone called out,
"He died a year after the war, in the last Battle of the Warehouses."
There was a tremor in the speaker's voice. Good. Surprise was not the only emotion at work here. Still, he needed something a lot better than that. The mayor was still staring at him, as perplexed as the others, but when he figured out what Gordon was trying to do, there would be trouble.
"Oh, well," Gordon called. "I'll have to confirm that, of course."
Before anyone could speak, he hurried on, shuffling the packet in his hand.
"Is there a Mr. or Mrs. Franklin Thompson in town, or their son or daughter?"
Now the tide of hushed whispering carried almost a superstitious tone. A woman replied,
"Dead! The boy lived until last year. Worked on the Jaskawish stead. His folks were in Portland when it blew."
Damn! Gordon had only one name left. It was all very well to strike their hearts with his knowledge, but what he needed was somebody alive.
"Right," he called. "We'll confirm that. Finally, is there a Grace Horton here? A Miss Grace Horton! No, there ain't no Grace Horton!
The mayor shouted, confidence and sarcasm back in his voice.
I know everyone in my territory. Never been no Grace Horton in the 10 years since I arrived, you imposter! Can't you all see what he did? He found an old telephone book in town and copied down some names to stir us up with.
He shook a fist at Gordon.
Buddy, I rule that you are disturbing the peace and endangering the public health. You got 5 seconds to be gone before I order my men to fire.
Gordon exhaled heavily. Now, he had no choice. At least he could beat a retreat and lose nothing more than a little pride.
It was a good try, but you knew the chances of it working were slim. At least you had the bastard going there for a little while.
It was time to go. But to his surprise, Gordon found his body would not turn. His feet refused to move. All will to run away had evaporated. The sensible part of him was horrified as he squared his shoulders and called the mayor's bluff.
Assault on a postal courier is one of the few federal crimes that the pro tem Congress hasn't suspended for the recovery period, Mr. Mayor. The United States has always protected its mailmen.
He looked coldly into the glare of the lamp.
Always,
he emphasized. And for a moment, he felt a thrill. He was a courier, at least in spirit. He was an anachronism that the Dark Age had somehow missed when it systematically went about rubbing idealism from the world. Gordon looked straight toward the dark silhouette of the mayor and silently dared him to kill what was left of their shared sovereignty. For several seconds, the silence gathered. Then the mayor held up his hand.
One!
He counted slowly, perhaps to give Gordon time to run, and maybe for sadistic effect.
Two!
The game was lost. Gordon knew he should leave now, at once. Still, his body would not turn.
Three!
This is the way the last idealist dies, he thought.
These 16 years of survival had been an accident, an oversight of nature about to be corrected. In the end, all of his hard-won pragmatism had finally given way to a gesture. There was movement on the parapet. Someone at the far left was struggling forward. The guards raised their shotguns. Gordon thought he saw a few of them move hesitantly, reluctantly. Not that that would do him any good. The mayor stretched out the last count, perhaps a bit unnerved by Gordon's stubbornness. The raised fist began to chop down.
Mr. Mayor!
A woman's tremulous voice cut in, her words high-pitched with fear as she reached up to grab the boss man's hand.
Please, I...
The mayor shrugged her hands away.
Get away, woman. Get her out of here.
The frail shape backed away from the guards, but she cried out clearly.
I'm Grace Horton.
What? The mayor was not alone in turning to stare at her.
It's my maiden name. I was married the year after the second famine. That was before you and your men arrived.
The crowd reacted noisily. The mayor cried out.
Fools! He copied her name from a telephone book, I tell you.
Gordon smiled. He held up the bundle in his hand and touched his cap with the other.
Good evening, Miss Horton. It's a lovely night, yes? By the way, I happen to have a letter here for you from a Mr. Jim Horton of Pine View, Oregon. He gave it to me 12 days ago.
The people on the parapet all seemed to be talking at once. There were sudden motions and excited shouts. Gordon cupped his ear to listen to the woman's amazed exclamation and had to raise his voice to be heard.
Yes, ma'am, he seemed to be quite well. I'm afraid that's all I have on this trip, but I'll be glad to carry your reply to your brother on my way back after I finish my circuit down in the valley.
He stepped forward, closer to the light.
One thing, though, ma'am. Mr. Horton didn't have enough postage back in Pine View, so I'm going to have to ask you for $10, COD.
The crowd roared. Next to the glaring lantern, The figure of the mayor turned left and right, waving his arms and shouting, but nothing he said was heard as the gate swung open and people poured out into the night. They surrounded Gordon, a tight press of hot-faced, excited men, women, children. Some limped, others bore livid scars or rasped in tuberculin heaviness, and yet at that moment the pain of living seemed as nothing next to a glow of sudden faith. In the middle of it all, Gordon maintained his composure and walked slowly toward the portal. He smiled and nodded, especially to those who reached out and touched his elbow, or the wide curve of his bulging leather bag. The youngsters looked at him in superstitious awe. On many older faces, tears streamed. Gordon was in the middle of a trembling adrenaline reaction, but he squelched hard on the little glimmering of conscience, a touch of shame at this lie. The hell with it. It's not my fault they want to believe in the Tooth Fairy. I've finally grown up. I only want what belongs to me. Simpletons. Nevertheless, he smiled all around as the hands reached out and the love surged forth. It flowed about him like a rushing stream and carried him in a wave of desperate, unwanted hope into the town of Oak Ridge. Interlude. In spring orange blazes, dust of ancestors' glowers, cooling earth with hazes. Part 2. Cyclops. National Recovery Act. Provisionally extended Congress of the restored United States. Declaration. To all citizens. Let it be known by all now living within the legal boundaries of the United States of America that the people and fundamental institutions of the nation survive. Your enemies have failed in their aggression against humanity and have been destroyed. A provisional government, acting in continuous succession from the last freely elected Congress and executive of the United States, is vigorously moving to restore law, public safety, and liberty once more to this beloved land under the Constitution and the righteous mercy of the Almighty. To these ends, let it be known that all lesser laws and statutes of the United States are suspended, including all debts, liens, and judgments made before the outbreak of the Third World War. Until new codes are adopted by due process, local districts are free to meet emergency conditions as suitable, providing 1. The freedoms guaranteed under the Bill of Rights shall not be withheld from any man or woman within the territory of the United States. Trials for all serious crimes shall be by an impartial jury of one's peers. Except in cases of dire martial emergency, summary judgments and executions violating due process are absolutely forbidden. 2. Slavery is forbidden. Debt bondage shall not be for life, nor may it be passed from parent to child. 3. Districts, towns, and other entities shall hold proper secret ballot elections on every even-numbered year, in which all men and women over 18 years of age may participate. No person may use official coercion on any other person unless he or she has been so elected or is directly answerable to a person so elected. 4. In order to assist the national recovery, citizens shall safeguard the physical and intellectual resources of the United States. Wherever and whenever possible, books and pre-war machinery shall be salvaged and stored for the benefit of future generations. Local districts shall maintain schools to teach the young. The provisional government hopes to reestablish nationwide radio service by the year 2021. Until that time, all communications must be carried via surface mail. Postal service should be reestablished in the central and eastern states by the year 2011 and in the west by 2018. 5. Cooperation with United States mail carriers is a requirement of all citizens. Interference with a letter carrier's function is a capital crime. By order of the Provisional Congress,
Restored, United States of America, May 2009.
1. Curtain. The black bull terrier snarled and foamed. It yanked and strained at its chain, whipping froth at the excited, shouting men leaning over the low wooden walls of the arena. A scarred, one-eyed mongrel growled back at the pit bull from across the ring. Its rope tether hummed like a bowstring, threatening to tear out the ring bolt in the wall. The dog pit stank. The sick, sweet smoke of locally grown tobacco, liberally cut with marijuana, rose in thick, roiling plumes. Farmers and townspeople yelled deafeningly from rows of benches overlooking the crude arena. Those nearest the ring pounded on the wooden slats, encouraging the dog's hysterical frenzy. Leather-gloved handlers pulled their canine gladiators back far enough to grip their collars, then turned to face the VIP bench overlooking the center of the pit. A burly, bearded dignitary, better dressed than most, puffed on his homemade cigar. He glanced quickly at the slender man who sat impassively to his right, whose eyes were shaded by a visored cap. The stranger sat quite still, in no way showing his feelings. The heavyset official turned back to the handlers and nodded. 100 men shouted at once as the dogs were loosed. The snarling animals shot at one another like quarrels, their argument uncomplicated. Fur and blood flew as the crowd cheered. On the dignitaries' bench, the elders yelled no less fiercely than the villagers. Like them, most had bets riding on the outcome. But the big man with the cigar, the chairman of public safety for the town of Curtin, Oregon, puffed furiously without enjoyment, his thoughts cloudy and thick. Once more he glanced at the stranger sitting to his right. The thin fellow was unlike anyone else in the arena. His beard was neatly trimmed, his black hair cut and combed to barely pass over the ears. The hooded blue eyes seemed to pierce and inspect critically, like in the images of Old Testament prophets the chairman had seen in Sunday school as a boy, long before the Doom War. He had the weathered look of a traveler, and he wore a uniform, one no living citizen of Curtin had ever expected to see again. On the peak of the stranger's cap, the burnished image of a horseman gleamed in the light of the oil lanterns. Somehow, it seemed shinier than any metal had a right to be. The chairman looked at his shouting townspeople and sensed the difference about them tonight. The men of Curtin were yelling with more than their usual gusto at the Wednesday night fights. They, too, were aware of the visitor who had ridden up to the city gates 5 days ago, erect and proud like some god, demanding food and shelter and a place to post his notices, and who then began distributing mail. The chairman had money riding on one of the dogs, old Jim Schmidt's walleye, but his mind wasn't on the bloody contest on the sand below. He could not help glancing repeatedly at the postman. They had staged a special fight just for him, since he was leaving Curtin tomorrow for Cottage Grove.
"He isn't enjoying himself," the chairman realized unhappily.
The man who had turned their lives upside down was apparently trying to be polite, but just as obviously, he did not approve of dog fights. The chairman leaned over to speak to his guest.
"I suppose they don't do this sort of thing back east, do they, Mr. Inspector?"
The cool look on the man's face was his answer. The chairman cursed himself for a fool. Of course they wouldn't have dog fights. Not in St. Paul City, or Topeka, or Odessa, or any of the civilized regions of the restored United States, but here, here in ruined Oregon, so long cut off from civilization.
"Local communities are free to handle their affairs as they see fit, Mr. Chairman," the man replied. His compelling voice carried softly over the shouting in the arena. "Customs adapt to the times. The government in St. Paul City knows this. I've seen far worse in my travels."
"Absolved," he could read in the postal inspector's eyes. The chairman slumped slightly and looked away again. He blinked, and at first he thought it was the smoke irritating his eyes. He dropped the cigar and ground it out under his foot, but the stinging would not depart. The bull pit was out of focus, as if he were seeing it in a dream, as if for the very first time.
My God, the chairman thought. Are we really doing this? Only 17 years ago, I was a member of the Willamette Valley ASPCA. What's happened to us? What's happened to me?
Coughing behind his hand, he hid the wiping of his eyes. Then he looked around and saw that he was not alone. Here and there in the crowd, at least a dozen men had stopped shouting and were instead looking down at their hands. A few were crying openly, tears streaming down tough faces hardened from the long battle to survive. Suddenly, for a few of those present, the years since the war seemed compressed. Insufficient excuse. The cheering was ragged at the end of the fight. Handlers leapt into the pit to tend the victor and clear away the offal, but half the audience seemed to be glancing nervously at their leader and the stern, uniformed figure next to him. The slender man straightened his cap.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, but I think I'd better retire now. I have a long journey tomorrow. Good night, all.
He nodded to the elders, then rose and slipped on a worn leather jacket with a multicolored shoulder patch, a red, white, and blue emblem. As he moved slowly toward the exit, townsmen stood up silently and made way for him, their eyes downcast. The chairman of Curtin hesitated, then got up and followed, a murmur of voices growing behind him. The second event was never held that evening. 2. Cottage Grove. Cottage Grove, Oregon, April 16, 2011. 2. Mrs. Adele Thompson, Mayor of Pineview Village, Unreclaimed State of Oregon. Transmittal route, Cottage Grove, Curtin, Culp Creek, McFarland Point, Oak Ridge, Pine View. Dear Mrs. Thompson, this is the second letter I've sent back along our new postal route through the Willamette Forest region. If you received the first, you'll already know that your neighbors in Oak Ridge have chosen to cooperate after a few initial misunderstandings. I appointed Mr. Sonny Davis postmaster there, a pre-war resident of the area liked by all. By now, he should have re-established contact with you in Pine View. Gordon Krantz lifted his pencil from the sheaf of yellowed paper the citizens of Cottage Grove had donated for his use. A brace of copper oil lamps and two candles flickered over the antique desk, casting bright reflections off glass-framed pictures on the bedroom wall. The locals had insisted Gordon take the best quarters in town. The room was snug, clean, and warm. It was a big change from the way things had been for Gordon only a few months before. In the letter, for instance, he said little about the difficulties he had faced last October in the town of Oak Ridge. The citizens of that mountain town had opened their hearts to him from the first moment he revealed himself as a representative of the restored United States. But the tyrannical mayor almost had his unwelcome guest murdered before Gordon managed to make it clear he was only interested in setting up a post office and moving on, that he was no threat to the mayor's power. Perhaps the boss man feared his people's reaction if he didn't help Gordon. In the end, Gordon received the supplies he asked for, and even a valuable, if somewhat elderly, horse. On leaving Oak Ridge, Gordon had seen relief on the mayor's face. The local chief seemed confident he could keep control in spite of the stunning news that a United States still existed out there, somewhere. And yet, townspeople followed Gordon for over a mile, appearing from behind trees to shyly press letters into his hands, eagerly talking about the reclamation of Oregon and asking what they could do to help. They complained openly of a petty local tyranny, and by the time he had left that last crowd on the road, it was clear that a change was blowing in the wind. Gordon figured the mayor's days were numbered. Since my last letter from Culp Creek, I've established post offices in Palmerville and Curtin.
Today I completed negotiations with the mayor of Cottage Grove. Included in this packet is a report on my progress so far to be passed on to my superiors in the reclaimed state of Wyoming. When the courier following my trail arrives in Pine View, please give him my records and my best wishes. And be patient if it takes a while. The trail west from St. Paul City is dangerous, and it may be more than a year before the next man arrives.
Gordon could well imagine Mrs. Thompson's reaction on reading that paragraph. The scrappy old matriarch would shake her head and maybe even laugh out loud at the sheer blarney that filled every sentence. Better than anybody else in the wild territory that had once been the great state of Oregon, Adele Thompson knew there would be no couriers from the civilized East. There was no headquarters for Gordon to report back to. The only thing the city of St. Paul was capital of was a still slightly radioactive bend in the Mississippi River. There had never been a reclaimed state of Wyoming, or a restored United States for that matter, except in the imagination of an itinerant, dark age con artist doing his best to survive in a deadly and suspicious world.